or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
It seems like it's the quintessential dilemma, especially here in the Bay Area, for people who are figuring out what the hell they want to do career-wise. Should they go for more money and work for a for-profit? Or should they work for less money for a nonprofit, as is probably well known here, that especially among the KLW listeners, but in the Bay Area more generally, there is this general feeling that for-profit is less worthy than a nonprofit. So, although, you know, that I'll leave to another day, I suppose, the question of the validity of that, although probably that'll get discussed briefly. But I thought it would be fun, you know, those of you who are regular listeners to the show know that my favorite way of dealing with complicated issues in which there's more than one side is to do something called a switch sides in the middle debate, in which I have a debate partner and I take one side of the debate, the other person takes the other, and then in the middle, we switch sides and take the opposite position so that the listener, doesn't have to figure out who's the better debater, because we're both taking both sides, but rather which side seems to have the stronger arguments. And my go-to gal in the area of my debate partner is my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemko. She has at this point won more national awards as superintendent than is worth taking the time for, so I'll simply say, hey, wifey, how you doing?
Good morning. Thank you.
Okay. So, all right. As usual, you tend to like to be in the respondent role. So why don't I start by taking the argument that it's better to take that $40,000 a year, say, nonprofit job rather than an $80,000 for-profit job, and then you'll take the other side. How's that sound?
Be my guest.
Okay.
Go for it.
Well, truthfully, you know, because so many people here in the Bay Area do have nonprofit values at their core, or they profess them, that if they're to be not hypocritical, the core nonprofit, principle is that it's wisest to redistribute from the haves, people who have more money, have more power, or whatever, to those who have less. That the consistent thing to do then is to avoid the for-profit world, which is all about making products and services and for people who can afford to pay, whereas nonprofits work for the poor. To hell with investments. You know, that's what especially corporations, they're supposed to be creating investments for people, buying stocks or whatever. So if you're really going to walk the talk, if you have, quote, traditional Bay Area, if you will, KALW values, you have to, in order to not being a hypocrite, you've got to take that $40,000 a year job. And you will, if you really do hold those values, will feel better about it if you do take that. Also, the employees and the volunteers are more likely to be idealistic. You know, there are conservative as well as liberal ways of being idealistic, but again, in the Bay Area way of things, more the employers and volunteers are more likely to think about making a better world, not just, you know, a better company, a better widget, a better product, making money for their families. And so there's an argument for taking the $40,000 job. And also, the truth is, if you live consistent with those liberal Bay Area nonprofit values, and therefore live modestly and live lightly on the earth, and you don't buy a lot of stuff, and or at least you have somebody supporting you, you can live on $40,000 a year, especially since the income that you'd earn between $40,000 and $80,000, say I'm comparing this to a for-profit job that makes twice as much, is taxed. And I did this carefully. I checked it out. 43%. You'd be paying 25% of that $40,000 in federal, 9% more in state, 7.65% in Social Security and Medicare, and almost 1%, 0.9% in disability. So that's 43%. So the after-tax difference between a $40,000 a year and $80,000 a year salary is just $23,000 a year, $442 a week. So if you're living modestly, consistent with those Bay Area non-property values, you're probably not going to live that much worse. And finally, people who like nonprofit values tend to value collaboration rather than competition, and there is more likely to be collaborative decision making, and you're going to fit better if you indeed work at a nonprofit. And those are the reasons why, especially if you're a person who typically espouses Bay Area liberal values, almost always votes Democratic or socialist, you know, as in a Bernie Sanders, or and who's that kind of a person, you'd be a fool to take a job working for for-profit, even at $80,000, twice as much as $40,000, for all the reasons that I outlined. Okay, now, Barb, you make the argument why it would be wiser to take the $80,000 a year job at a good, I'm not saying a sleazy tobacco company, but a good for-profit, rather than the $40,000 nonprofit.
Well, let's think about what some of these for-profit companies produce and how they've changed the lives of all of us. When we were growing up, it was rare to have an air conditioner in the house. Today, most people can afford to have air conditioning, and they have washer dryers in the house. They don't have to go up to the roof or in the backyard and hang out their laundry, and dishwashers, and cars, and TVs. So all of these things that have so enhanced our lives were produced by for-profit companies. Let's look at the fact that if you work for a for-profit, it's more likely that you're going to work in an attractive workplace. Nonprofits usually can't afford to have very glamorous places, and it sort of would go against the whole ethos of the nonprofit. But for-profit companies can be beautiful, delightful places to spend your days. And if you're good, the potential for reward and advancement is much greater because they have the money to be able to do that. So you can move up the ladder. And frankly, if you move up the ladder and you're making more money, you probably can donate more of your money to the nonprofit that's so important to you, and you'll be doing more good than if you just work for a nonprofit. If you're trying to work for a nonprofit, it's harder to get a job because it seems these days everybody wants to do that. So you may have a better chance of getting a job in the for-profit world. And actually, there are so many incentives that come from the for-profit world. I talked about a lot of the lower prices and all the goods and services that we get, but people invest in these for-profit companies, and they make money that way. So, again, you can make more money, donate that money, and work in a really nice place and get rewarded, get promoted. It's a great thing to work for a for-profit.
Okay, terrific. I'm just going to make a very brief rejoinder, and then we're going to switch roles.
Oh, good. And then I'm going to do another rejoinder.
Oh,
you
good.
First. You rejoin first.
Well, many people in the Bay Area would say that while on the surface, air conditioning and dishwashers and all that electrical stuff is good, it's despoiling the planet. It's using a lot of energy, and ultimately that's not good. And the fact to say that for-profits are necessarily more attractive than non-profits, it really depends. There are some plenty non-profit. I mean, frankly, if I go to the studios of KQED, that is about as plush as it gets in their non-profit, whereas, of course, KLW is much more modest, so you can't really generalize to that. And the point I'd like to agree with that you raise is it really is probably easier, paradoxically, to get a job in the for-profit sector here in the Bay Area because there is such a belief in the non-profit and government sector. Those are my little rejoinders. You said you had a little rejoinder. Please do.
I do. I have two.
Great.
One is all those things that you said, the air conditioners, the washer dryers and things, are not good for the planet. I don't see anybody in either the profit or nonprofit world giving up their washer and dryer to go hang their laundry out and washing it on the old washboard my mother used. And two, you said that with all the taxes that you pay, the difference is merely $442 a week. Do you know what one person can do with $442 extra dollars a week? That's a fortune.
That is excellent. All fair rejoinders. Great job as usual, Barbara. So now, first let our listeners know what you're listening to. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. We are doing what we call a switch sides in the middle debate, in which one of us takes one side for the first half of the debate, and then we take the other side the second half. And the topic that we're debating today is the question of whether it is ultimately wiser, especially this show is very Bay Area-centric, and so I've tailored it to the dominant ethos among the Bay Area, especially among KLW listeners. So would it be better to work for $40,000 at a good nonprofit or $80,000 for a good for-profit? We're not creating straw men here. We're not talking about tobacco companies, really evil. There are some evil companies or companies that create crappy products that are just marks that survive on marketing but really are crappy. We're talking about a good nonprofit and a good for-profit. And I started by taking the side that it was worth I don't have to reiterate that, but it's now Barbara's turn to make the best argument you can for why ultimately it's wiser to take that $40,000 nonprofit job.
Well, in this life, we all want to feel good about what we do. And if you're working hard for a cause that you believe in, you're getting up every day and you're doing something you love. You're going to work at a place that you really care about, and you feel like you're making a huge contribution. And frankly, if you live in the Bay Area, you're going to get tremendous admiration from friends and colleagues and neighbors because you are living the dream. You're working for something that's important to you. You're going to make enough money that you can live a middle-class life. It's not going to be fancy, and you're probably not going to jet off to Paris for the weekend. But how important is that to do when you can be helping the cause that's very important to you? Nonprofits tend to be very collaborative because everybody's deciding jointly how best they can serve this cause that's so important, and that feels a lot better on a day-to-day basis than having some boss tell you what you have to do when maybe in order to make profits you have to do something that you don't believe in so much. So you are living life consistent with your values, and you are doing something that makes you feel good about going to work every day. And they say if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. So how can it be better than that?
As usual, you've done well, really well, arguing both sides. I appreciate that very much. Now
thank
I will
you.
Close. Yep. And by the way, dear listeners, right after I close, we're going to invite you to call in and say, obviously, it's not which person won the debate because we both took both sides, but which side feels more compelling? Or you can certainly amplify. I'm sure we haven't covered every argument. We would like you to add layers to the conversation, add nuance. That's what public radio is about, adding more complexity, not sound bites, not crap you put on a bumper sticker. So, you know, get yourself ready. After I do want you to listen to my closing statement regarding why it's better to work for the for-profit. But then afterwards, we're going to invite you to call in. So, okay. So here is my best shot at an argument for why it's better worth to make $80,000 for a good for-profit than $40,000 for a good nonprofit. Absolutely. First of all, I want to just agree with Barbara's points that $442 extra a week can really make a difference in your quality of life. So that's a legitimate point, even though it will 43% of the income would be taxed more. And it may, paradoxically, be easier to get an $80,000 job in a for-profit in the Bay Area than a $40,000 nonprofit job, because so many nonprofits, because there's so many people in the Bay Area who want to work for nonprofits, they make many of the positions volunteer. So you can't even get to $40,000. It's really very hard to get even a $40,000 job. But now I want to make more stronger arguments for why I think, not stronger than Barbara's, but as strong argument as I can for why I think working for the for-profits really is very defensible, even on a socially responsible perspective. Indeed, as Barbara gave examples of air conditioning and dishwasher, but every damn product you use, from the Bayer aspirin you take to the Toyota you drive to the shirt you buy, almost everything is made by a for-profit. And if it was left for the nonprofit world, they probably wouldn't even be made. I mean, not that everything we can analogize from the former Soviet Union, but in places like Cuba and in the former Soviet Union, there were drastic shortages, so that even everybody, even the ostensible, the worker, the proletariat, was unable to get even basics like sugar. I was driving to Napa, and I saw past the CNH sugar plant, which is a company, and it was Saturday night, and I saw there was still the effluent of was from coming up from the sugar processing. Was they were working 24/7 to make sure that I can go to my Trader Joe's or my Safeway, and for $2.44, which is the actual price, I can buy 4 pounds of sugar. That is a miracle of efficiency and enabling everybody, rich and poor. For anybody to say that that kind of work is unethical or less ethical than working for a nonprofit, which very often, while the causes feel very heartwarming, we all know that, for example, the achievement gap is as wide as it's ever been, despite billions and billions and billions spent on these nonprofit ventures. So whereas these for-profits are with far greater certainty doing tremendous good. And what about the fact that these big corporations, we can invest in them? Whether it be my son or daughter who wants to buy her share of Disney stock or Pixar stock or Apple stock, that child can start, instead of just being a wage slave, sorry, and certainly that's as an adult, requiring only being able to make as much money as he can work on his or her back, he can take that money, if he or she is thrifty, and invest it in a corporation, the best and brightest people. I invest a fair amount of money in Amazon, which in my career counseling practice I've learned, in general, has the best and brightest people working for it. I can, if I am willing to be thrifty and not throw it away on unimportant purchases, I can have the best and brightest people in the world working for me, and my getting a return on average. Of course, I can lose, but I can also make money. And, you know, the most charitable people in this world were the people who are the ultimate capitalists, the Warren Buffetts and the Bill Gates, who have given billions of dollars. They've made money where you can make money, that is in the for-profit world. And then Bill Gates is trying to immunize every kid in Africa from malaria and everything else. Who could say that because he made his money selling Microsoft Word, which I use every day, or Microsoft Windows, which is an intuitive, easy to understand operating system, whereas he could say, can anybody say that that is unethical work? Of course not. Also, for profits, when you're we're talking about working at them, they tend to be more efficient, and so they, instead of requiring collaboration and three signatures to blow your nose, which is more often the norm in the nonprofits, you can get stuff done more readily. And because it's less collaborative and there is a greater measure of individual initiative, although there's plenty of collaboration in the for-profit world, because more decisions can be made by the leaders who are not just selected at random, but who are generally brighter on average, and fewer decisions need to be made by the team, there can be bolder decisions and therefore progress more rapidly made. And that's why it is, in my judgment, in this taking this side of the argument, it's wiser ultimately to go for the $80,000 a year in a for-profit than the $40,000 in the nonprofit. Barbara, did you want to make a brief rejoinder to that, or should we go to the phones?
Oh, let's go to the phones.
Great. So now let me invite you, my dear listeners. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. We have just concluded a switch sides in the middle debate on the question of, is it wiser, and I love that word, wiser, to work for $40,000 at a good nonprofit or $80,000 for a good for-profit? We welcome, you're not saying who won, because Barbara and I both took both sides, but which side feels stronger to you, or if you'd like to amplify, in other words, you've come up with another argument that you think hasn't been mentioned, or you want to expand or give an example. All of those are good reasons to join the conversation here at Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco at KALW. The phone number for all that, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now we've got callers already on the line before I even get out the phone number. So let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for a great conversation.
You're welcome.
I want to comment on an incentive issue with, you know, how you get the best and the brightest, and why I think that the nonprofit field could be more efficient.
Okay.
And actually not have to pay such low wages, to kind of make this question a little less divisive in a way.
Okay.
I think that, you know, there's a mentality in the nonprofit sector, and I speak as a nonprofit executive myself, that or these organizations, there's kind of a suffering Olympics, I'd call it. Where people kind of compete to be the most holier than thou they possibly can be. And in doing so, the incentive structure gets messed up within the organization.
Great points. Give an example. That really is a beautiful point that was not raised. Please expand on that. Explain.
So I would say that instead of having a quantifiable, tangible outcome from your work, a lot of the work is ego gratification, not to belittle it, but that's basically what it comes down to is, I'm doing such important work for the world that, and I'm taking so little for it, aren't I great? A good example would be, I think that nonprofit executives get paid, you know, close to a tenth or something of really successful for-profit executives. And what you get as a result is people who are really motivated by that kind of gratification of ego, for lack of a better term, instead of people who are really good at getting goals accomplished and measuring their results.
So really excellent point. Barbara, I want to thank you very much. Barbara, do you have anything to add? Or I just said, there's nothing I can add. That was a great call.
He said that very well.
Great. I appreciate you're an honored member of the Work with Marty and Barbara workforce. Thank you so much for contributing to the conversation.
You're welcome. And Marty, there's one more thing. There's a guy named Dan Pallotta who did a great TED Talk about this, and his last name is Pallotta.
Uh-huh.
And the TED Talk is called "The Way We Think About Charity Is Dead Wrong."
I love it. I appreciate your call very much.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Right. Wonderful. We'll give out the phone number again, and then we'll go back to the phones. If you have a comment about this issue of whether it is wiser to work for $40,000 for a nonprofit or $80,000 for a for-profit, we'd love to hear from you. The phone number here, work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And we had calls on the line, but it looks like they got scared, or maybe they heard everything they needed to hear. So I think what we'll do is just, if people don't call in, Barbara, do you want, instead of taking both sides, if you were I like using the term, the goddess within you, the wise woman within you, and you yourself were faced with a decision to work for $80,000. You were for $80,000 for a good for-profit. Let's just say it's a good profit. Let's just say, for argument's sake, let's just say Google. You were going to work for $80,000 for at Google, or maybe that's not fair because they're considered. I'm cherry picking. That's too preeminent.
And you can't just get a job for Google.
Yeah. Let's take a middle. You're for the Ace Widget Company, that makes a perfectly honorable, let's say, just a circuit board that runs. Electronic products, okay? It's nothing evil, nothing fabulous. You get an $80,000 job, the same job title, whatever it is. Let's just say you were in marketing or whatever, for that Ace Widget Company, or $40,000 for, let's say, I know you believe in, and so do I, Planned Parenthood. Let's say you had a $40,000 job to work for Planned Parenthood. Which would you take and why?
I'd go for profit. I like the $80,000. I'm thinking of all the things that $442 a week would allow me to do. For one, I could live in a much nicer place, because multiply that by 4 weeks in a month, and I got a lot more money to spend on housing, and maybe some money left over to go out to dinner. And those are all things that would enhance my quality of life.
It would enhance a normal person. But as you know, I'm this atheist monk. I would take the $40,000.
Yeah, you should have been a monk,
yeah.
Actually.
I am very much in favor of nonprofits and for-profit. I love companies. But I suppose I suffer from exactly what that great caller said, the suffering Olympics. I am this self-denying person. I probably would work for a nonprofit cause. my cause is I really care about gifted kids, and they're totally ignored in the schools, and I believe they have so much potential. So I'd probably search out that $40,000 a year job working to enhance programs for gifted kids, and that's going to be more likely to be nonprofit. That's probably what I would do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Anyway, now all the lines.
You don't care. You don't need that $442.
No, I would live in a basement apartment. I don't need anything. I could, as long as it wasn't toxic and I wasn't having mold. Breathing stacky brotas, whatever that was called, black mold, I'd probably be fine. Look, my car's got 270,000 miles on it, my old Toyota. So, clearly I'm a person of a self-flagellating era. Anyway, let's go. Can you believe we've been together 42 years with this kind of disparate values? That is the eighth wonder of the Western world. Let's
do it.
Let's go to the phone.
Maybe the ninth.
Yeah, right. What's the eighth? If that's the ninth, what's the eighth?
Oh, I don't know, but there's got to be something between us and seven wonders of the world.
Maybe the miracle that is that I've lasted 26 years at KALW. That's bizarre as well. Anyway, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco, Barbara Nemco. What's your thought about whether it's wiser to work for $80,000 for a for-profit, all things being equal, or $40,000 for a good non-profit? Are you
Hello?
There? Hello.
Am I on the air?
You are.
Oh, well, anyway, I've been with non-profits for about 11 years.
Okay.
And I made just under $40,000 a year.
Right.
And I would rather do what I've been doing for the past 11 years than be in the Rolling Stones or be a senator or anything else or be the head of Amazon or anything else.
Great. Tell us why. That's great.
And the work is so incredibly rewarding. And this whole, and the previous guy, who was talking about, he needed innovative people. I improved any job I've taken in the nonprofit world. I've got a little bit merit raises and all this other stuff. Obviously, there's not a lot of money. But the idea is that people aren't giving their best and always improving their own work and the work of the agency. I'm afraid that's a fallacy.
OK, Okay, well, I'm not saying, or he didn't say it isn't, it's just more that there's a tendency. But I'm interested, tell me, though, has there been a moment in your 11 years in that nonprofit that you found particularly gratifying in a way that you probably couldn't have accomplished in a for-profit?
Oh, absolutely. Many, many, many.
Tell me one.
Let's say my specialty has become assisting homeless people with mental illness find
mm-hmm.
housing.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been people who have come to me with their world in a hefty bag who are now in subsidized housing, going back to school. Some have joined the workforce.
Great.
Okay.
I appreciate your call very much. Now, we've got a lot of calls on the line, but I very much value your perspective. You too.
I understand, but I just want to say I wouldn't do what I'm doing for anything else.
I love it.
Thank you very much, Mark.
I'm thrilled you called. All right. Let's go back to the phones.
It's clear.
Yeah, it's great. I love that we're hearing all sides. It's great. Welcome to Work with Martin Amco and Barbara Amco. What is your perspective on the issue of whether it's wiser ultimately to work for $40,000 for a nonprofit or $80,000 for a for-profit?
Hi, Marty. Thanks. It's an interesting topic. And I think it depends. So I worked for, 12 years in nonprofit, at a national nonprofit, doing a lot of strategy and high-level stuff, and before that in for-profit, and went back to for-profit and work at a big company now. And I think a lot depends on the more clear you are about your values and what you're trying to get out of the work that you do, the easier this decision is, because if you're making a values-based decision, it's not so much about the salary but about what kind of impact you'll have in whichever job you're doing. You can find the right job in the right place, because depending on, for some roles and areas of focus, nonprofit can be a challenging place to be, because they don't really, they just don't try hard enough. So if you're, in things like, I did a lot of digital strategy, but that can be very hard to accomplish in nonprofit, and so you feel like you're not really making a difference.
Is it trying hard, or is it how much, I am not a big fan of all this emphasis on collaboration and process rather than getting crap done, getting stuff done. Is that correct that for you is a defining difference between the for-profit and nonprofit world rather than not trying hard?
I think nonprofits are, generally speaking, consensus-driven organizations.
Exactly.
But I've worked at for-profits that are that, too.
It's becoming more and more that way, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that the thing that the earlier caller said about just being committed to some, measurable goals mm-hmm. and being held accountable for things is important. That doesn't always happen in nonprofits. I think that there's this level of sort of organizational infrastructure that is hard for nonprofits to commit to, and that actually creates these huge barriers. It happens in government too, where you look at the rollout of the whole health care
right.
platform that was just
right.
a terrible rollout. Like Amazon wouldn't roll
right.
a product like
exactly.
that out. But that's a byproduct of these weird organizational structures. It's not a skill fat thing really,
mm-hmm.
and so. And part of that comes from this donor misperception around operational expense. So
good point.
Things that are like getting an up-to-date, just having the latest version of Windows on everyone's machine in a big national nonprofit costs a lot of money. And so that throws your operational expense percentage off. And then the donors look at it. They look at
efficiency, right.
GuideStar or whatever. And
right. Charity Navigator.
Yeah. Yeah,
so,
exactly. And so it's this bizarre, there's this crazy perception that every penny I give to this giant organization should go directly to, cancer research.
Direct service,
or on-the-ground services. And it's like, you can't, you wouldn't say that if you went to McDonald's and they said, well, all the money goes to the burgers, so the kitchen is disgusting, right? Like, you can't, the expectation is really contorted for nonprofits, which makes it hard for them to compete on these kind of core infrastructural components that you need to run a big company.
Great point, Barbara.
I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, can you apply that? I mean, you're the superintendent of Napa County of Education, and there's always tremendous criticism about the bureaucracy and all that. Do you want to comment about that, the spending of money on, quote, infrastructure, whether it be software, IT, or more people, or buildings, or processes? You want to talk about how much discussion goes on about efficiencies in process. Does that go on much when you have your cabinet meetings, Barbara?
Well, I think in terms of investing in infrastructure, we invest in the infrastructure that is important to kids in schools, like technology infrastructure. That's critical. When it came to building our building, we were very concerned with perception. What would our building look like? Because we built a building where we used to be renting space in a pretty grim location, frankly, the old U.S.
toxic
steel
location.
Plant.
Yeah, so but, I mean, you were saying you built a pretty modest damn building. Nobody
Absolutely.
Could call it palatial, but you moved it out of the, you know.
Deliberately,
yeah.
Because we could really show that we were going to save money over the long term from just throwing it away on rent, and that it would accommodate our growing needs. But certainly everything was done to be as modest as possible.
Yeah.
We didn't want anyone coming to the building and saying, oh, my God, they spend their money on things for the administrators and not on the kids.
Caller, I think your point is really excellent. And, of course, you know, analogy is such an easy thing to understand. So your analogy to McDonald's was spending on the burgers but not on the kitchen is a memorable one. It was those kind of sound bites that makes help people remember it. Your call is terrific, and I appreciate you very much.
Thanks.
Yep. Let's go back to the phones. What is your comment or question about this issue of whether it is wiser to spend to work for a nonprofit at $40,000 or $80,000 at a for-profit? It's you.
Hey.
Hi.
All right. I think that you know, it really depends on the direction of the for-profit, but just a quick comment on the tax situation that you brought up. That if you have this $80,000 job and your federal taxes increase that much. I mean, the last statistics I saw, we were spending 57% or 54% of the federal budget goes towards military. Does that sound right to you?
To be honest, I do not know.
I think it's 57%. So if you look at, if you're securing more money, if you're securing $80,000 and you say, oh, you can donate more to the nonprofit, well, inherently you're donating more to this, to our federal government that is extremely, you know, friendly to the military industrial.
You know, that's going to be off topic. I'm going to, you know, there's no question a lot gets spent on the military, whether it's 53 or 33, it's huge, but also just government spending in general. I mean, it is, no one can claim that government tends to be efficient in how it spends. I mean, I just, you know, you read all of these things, and I try to avoid it because there's nothing I can do about it, but the amount that it costs, for example, yes, in these wars, or to provide a service for even job seekers. There's so much bureaucracy. There's so many committees. Anyway, so either way, but you do end up with more money in your pocket afterwards if you do work for more. But yes, more goes to the government for better or worse, and some of it is excess regulations, and who the hell knows. But yes, your point is right that you earn more, and a hell of a lot more is going to go to the government without question. Anyway, thank you for the call. Let's take one more call, and then I think, Barbara, let's move to another topic.
Okay.
Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. What is your comment on whether it's wiser ultimately to work for $40,000 for a nonprofit or $80,000 for a for-profit?
I'm actually interested in your comments on a couple of issues. First of all, in response to the caller who said that some people, it's ego versus measurable results,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I.e. nonprofit versus for-profit, that seems to me to be discussing, you know, people's need for status, which
mm-hmm.
is different in different communities.
Mm-hmm.
So that ego that he speaks of, that might apply in the for-profit or the nonprofit world. Either way, it is certainly not mutually exclusive to measurable results.
Let me respond. It may not be mutually exclusive, but there certainly are a lot of people who are less interested in, you know, whose primary drive. The caller, I think, he was very nuanced in the way he said it. There are many people whose primary driver is the notion of being part of, being seen as this great, you know, liberal person who's working for a nonprofit, and they're less interested in the nuts and bolts of getting stuff done. And I think there is some legitimacy to that, and they're going to get more. More of those people will be in the nonprofit, because you do get bragging rights in the Bay Area for working in nonprofits, where you don't get bragging rights for doing it in a for-profit. So he didn't say it's only that, but I think his point was well taken, that there is an overrepresentation of people who prefer to play in that suffering Olympics in the nonprofit sector.
Second question is, and I'm interested in what you think, it's my opinion that oftentimes the problem with many nonprofits is that so much of the work is related directly or indirectly to raising revenue and not so much about addressing the
needs
directly.
That's true. I have nothing to say, but it's because money is the lifeblood of every organization, and the way in which companies raise the money is they go to banks, or they go to their friends, or they go public, and the nonprofit way is fundraising. So, yes, unfortunately, a lot of the effort goes into fundraising, and it's unavoidable.
Thanks. Great show.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I can't help it. The people, you know, your listeners, you're first, so let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco, Barbara Nemco. What is your thought, and you do get the last word, on whether it's wiser to work for a $40,000 for a good nonprofit or $80,000 for a good for-profit?
Hello. Yes, I would just like to point out that working for a large corporation oftentimes requires making, either you have to ignore the bad things the corporation is doing, or you're complicit in helping bringing about those bad things.
Give an example.
Well, you gave the example of Microsoft. There are a lot of ethical concerns about that company. It's support of software patents. It's support of the PRISM program of spying on law-abiding citizens. The fact that it puts out software, which is so easily exploited by criminals overseas, which puts their own users at risk, there's a long list of things that Microsoft has done, Google has done, Apple has done, that, well, I mean, you have to choose a for-profit profit company that hasn't done all these things in order to be yourself operating ethically.
I guess it also depends on one's ethics. First of all, certainly for-profits don't have a monopoly on bad behavior. You know, the churches have stolen all kinds of money and appropriated money, and not to mention having sex with little boys. You know, nonprofits executed, there have been many scandals of them. And then there's the whole question of what is ethical. Is a patent ethical? That is a question that is an interesting one. I may do a future debate on this. Is intellectual property something that is worthy of preserving, that is, patents and copyrights and whatever, or should everything be public domain? You know, that is a very interesting question that needs to be evaluated in terms of all of the effects on all the stakeholders of the world. It is not a priori a given that having a patent is a bad thing. And is all spying a bad thing? Is spying to prevent terrorism, to what is, you know, where is it? Is it what is worth focusing on? And there's where we want to focus, not on bumper sticker rhetoric, but on the nuances of where is the greatest good accruing. Anyway, I want to thank you very much for the call. Barbara, do you have anything else you want to say regard to capstone our discussion about for-profit versus non-profit, or are we ready to change topics?
I think our callers have really filled in anything that
we didn't say
and done it well. So
love them.
Time to move on.
Thank you all of you who called in, and also those of you who refrained from calling in because you felt that maybe it was already discussed or whatever. I think this was a very worthy 37 minutes, and I think all of us at KLW, listeners, hosts alike, should feel good that this is what public radio should be, in my judgment. This is the time of year. Moving on to another topic. This is the time of year that millions of parents and teenagers who are thinking about, where am I going to apply for high school? Mostly we procrastinate, and now they're seniors in high school. And it is October, and November 30th is the deadline for the University of California and for Cal States, and the privates. You're starting now to get your applications. So I thought, what could be a better time to explore what are the factors that you should be using in choosing a college? And who better to do that with than Barbara, who's deeply involved in education? And so I want to talk about, and by the way, dear listeners, I'm aware that I have a significant component of listeners who are beyond the age where they're either going to college themselves or even the parents. So you could be a grandparent or an uncle or whatever. So just think about this in terms of, you will likely run into somebody, whether even at a cocktail party, who's going to be, they're going to say, oh, my kid is going to be applying to colleges. And maybe you will be armed with a little bit of perhaps more sophisticated information to help guide them to making a wiser decision, because we end up choosing colleges so disproportionately based on the prestige of the college. If it's got a bitter brand name, which is usually a proxy for how much research they're doing or how hard it is to get in, we assume it's a better college, which is absurd. Both for a variety of reasons, but most importantly is, more important is the fit for a kid. Because a kid, even if he could get into Stanford or she, some kids of that caliber are wiser to be the big fish in a less selective pond. But let me start talking about one criteria. I'm going to, as usual, you like to be, Barbara, in the respondent mode. So I'm going to make the arguments about my thoughts about whether a college offers a major, how important should that be in determining the college? I actually think that if the kid made reasonable efforts to explore a range of options, and there are these long lists of majors that most kids have never heard of, that are, for example, put out by the College Board, if the kid did some of that reviewing and then really did pick a major that felt that, oh, yeah, there's a better than 50-50 chance I'm going to stay with this major. You know, they're fascinated about entomology, or they know they want to be a nurse, or they know that they want to be in nonprofit management or something. It's perfectly fine for the student to choose a college in part based on that, even though it's obvious that many students change their major. Why not at least start with a college that has that major? If you don't change, great. If you do change, it's still, every college has got a zillion other majors. And that's, I guess, my basic thought. Like where it becomes even more primary. I'll stop there. What are your thoughts about that, I like to think, nuanced opinion about the extent to which a major should be one of the factors in choosing a college?
Well, even if you were to change majors later, remember that one of the most important things that we do in college is we make friends and connections. Mm-hmm. And by choosing according to the major that you're currently interested in, the people who you're going to meet there are more likely going to be very compatible with your thinking at this time.
Mm. It's a great point, because when you attend a college, we end to find little homes. Sometimes the home is your dorm mate. Sometimes it is a club you join. But sometimes it can be people in that major, so that if you are interested, for example, in accounting, there is always an accounting club or an accounting majors club, and you can go to their meetings and find kindred spirits. So that's a good point. So another criterion that is very important in choosing a college is selectivity. And I implied this earlier. Don't necessarily prioritize the colleges that are hardest to get into. Yes, some students do better when they are among more capable classmates. So, you know, if you're a weak student, but you got into Stanford or Berkeley, and that tends to bring out the best in you because you care about competing and you're going to rise to the challenge, and your peers, you know, that just the peer norm expectation, great. But there are many other kids, especially those who tend to be anxious and insecure, who equally bright would do better as the big fish in a less selective pond. So even if they get into Stanford or in Berkeley, they would be better off a notch down, for example, at UC Davis, where the competition isn't quite as rigorous. That can enable their anxiety to be less, and still, especially if they're more self-driven and they don't need the peer pressure to drive them, they might well be better off rejecting a Stanford in favor of a UC Davis. Again, one size does not fit all. What's your reaction to that?
Totally agree. I was the kid who, in high school, when they put me initially in all honors classes, sort of withered under the pressure, felt very inadequate, very insecure. But as soon as they took me out of honors classes and put me in regular classes, I was a shining star.
Yep.
And it felt a whole lot better to be a shining star than the person who was afraid to say anything in class because all these other people I perceived as being so much smarter than I was.
And what's really interesting about that, and much more broadly applicable to the job world, when you're in school, the metric on which your potential is judged is academic prowess. But in the real world, academic prowess often takes a back seat to other factors, especially in balance. you know, you may never have been, even though you have a PhD from Berkeley, you may never have been the academic superstar that some other people are, but because you have these other attributes, being smart yet calm, having good emotional intelligence, having an excellent work ethic, being completely low maintenance, you're never up and down, you're solid as a rock. The fact that you were only very good in regular classes but not great in AP classes is trivial. So dear listeners, don't, you know, sometimes it could be 10 or 20 or 40 years after you graduated high school or college, and you're still feeling like you're not that great because you were not an A student at a top college. In the real world, and as I said at the top of the show, Barbara has won many national awards now for best technology superintendent, superintendent of the year, woman of the year, and she was not Ms. Superstar academically. You need a relative amount of reading skills, writing skills, critical thinking skills, but after a certain point, it's more of a silly competition as to whether you're better academically. And in fact, some of the wisest ways of spending time in college is not to spend your discretionary time going from a 3.5 to a 3.9, but rather spending the time developing your natural non-academic skills, whether it be in leadership or in a hobby or organization or student government or whatever. Anything you want to add to that?
Take it away from me. It's got nothing to do with me. Let's look at what are the skills that are most critical in the workplace. And everybody will tell you that number one is communication.
It's true.
Nobody cares that you got an A+ on your geometry midterm.
Right.
That never has come up in any work I have done in the last how many decades.
Or not just you, but anybody. How many people? It's almost nobody. Yeah.
So
even engineers.
What we need to be able to do is learn how to listen well, a skill that they don't teach in school.
It seems so easy.
Somehow listening is assumed. They think we assume that if you're hearing, you're listening. Those are two very different things.
Yeah.
And speaking, writing, those are key.
And I also, of course, we are in a more technological age now, so it's usually you do need to have some technical chops, even the technical side of marketing.
Technical skills, yes.
Yeah, but I mean, even in the technical side of marketing or the technical side, not necessarily even programming, the technical side of digital communication and the ability to use that. So it's not just about communication, but certainly that is very important. I want to invite the listeners to call in. If you or someone you care about is in the throes of thinking about where should they apply to college or graduate school and would either like to ask us a question, this is something we can really comment on pretty well, we invite you to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, for your college-related questions, 415-841-4134. What's that the number for? Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco here at KALW, 415-841-4134. Another criterion that's important in choosing a college, which is dismissed and yet it's critical, is location. It's very much an underrated factor because location affects the student every day. So in other words, some kids would be wise to be in a warm climate or in a milieu. We just talked about some guy, child of a very rich person, who decided that he was going to send his kid back east to Northeast, to one of the prestigious colleges in Maine. And in the end, the kid is very likely to be unhappy because the culture is so different in that preppy, prep school, Northeastern New England culture than it was here in Northern California. So location is critical. What about the fact about being within laundry distance of home? Some kids need psychologically, appropriately, they need to be able to have the realistic option of coming home for the weekend. I call it laundry distance of home. Others really do, maybe because the parents are overbearing or the kid really is ready to want to be more autonomous, should go for a completely different geographic location and different culture. Some people might be sick and tired of a certain Northern California ethos and might do well to be, for example, in New York City. So location is a very important component, but an overrated part of that is the proximity to a city. Generally, students find plenty to do on campus and they rarely venture into the city. When Amy went to UCLA, what was the percentage of time she went into LA? Almost never. Almost everything occurred on campus. Any comments about the location question?
I also think the location re-weather question is huge.
Right.
If you've grown up in a warm climate and a temperate climate like the Bay Area and you suddenly find yourself on the East Coast, it's a shock. between the humidity in the summer and the cold in the winter, it can make your day-to-day life very unpleasant. To go outside on the East Coast in the middle of the winter is a five-minute layering up process and then a five-minute layering down process when you get to where you're going. It's a royal annoyance every day.
Yeah, of course, they're not there in the summer for the school year, so the humidity usually never is an issue, except you with your hair, who was worried about that? That's going to be an issue no matter what.
That's right. Yeah. Humidity is an issue for me every day.
Something also, though, in terms of the weather, young people are generally more resilient. They're not as concerned about the cold. They tend to adapt better. Yeah, they may have to get dressed up. But, you know, there are a lot of people who are what I call environmentally centric. And so for them, experiencing a four seasons climate is almost temporarily something that is a plus for them. So, again, nuance.
Know your kid.
Okay, plenty of lines lighted up here, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. What is your question or comment related to choosing a college or graduate school? Hi,
yes,
it's you.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling because I have a super bright high school graduate who was a fairly good student. And I'm wondering, though, for maximum success, He has interests that are not sort of run-of-the-mill, kind of, you know, a quirky, different kind of kid. And so for maximum, like, loves to learn, but never really kind of is committed to one thing or the other. As I said, you know, a B-plus student, but nothing ever really rocked his socks. My question is, I'm wondering if aptitude tests in this day and age are a way to kind of, as you say, get to know your student better and really then take the opportunity to look at all of the majors, as you said, to really explore what's a good fit.
I love that question. I'm going to take a very contrarian position. I have come to the conclusion that almost all pencil and paper tests, aptitude as well as personality, are probably less accurate than the parent's perception of the kid in the real world, because the parent has a far broader sense of what that kid is like. And the validity of aptitudes in term beyond IQ, which has got a dirty word, but the SAT is a proxy for it, but really the ability to reason rigorously, to learn quickly, not just memorize, but abstract, think broadly, come up with conclusions, deduce, induce, create syntheses, that doesn't fully get as examined in the test as should be. So as I believed you when you said your kid is very bright, although not a great student, and a dabbler, loves to learn, curious. So I think the larger and really thorny question is, does he need to acquire a technical expertise as the launch pad for many careers? These days, the ability to know something about programming and computer design or a biology, a molecular biology, ends up being a prerequisite to getting hired for a decent job in so many more fields. And the intellectual curiosity can come later, or is he just not that way, and he is somebody who simply needs to be this general liberal arts major, learn a little bit about everything, and then perhaps in graduate school decide he's going to be a doctor, a lawyer, a medical researcher, a public policy person, or whatever. Having said that, what does your intuition say is right for your son or daughter?
Well, you know, you talked about entomology, and ever since this kid has been, you know, old enough to venture outside, he's brought me home bugs and beetles and butterflies and, you know, and mounted them. And, you know, in the fifth grade, when he was five, he'd come home and say that he was talking about echolocation and bats with his classmates.
Mm-hmm. This is sounding a little bit like...
But he does have that ability. He does have that intellectual ability to make the leap. He can extrapolate. He can, you know, think out of the box.
Right.
And I guess my thing is to try to... It's not the intellectual piece necessarily that I'm worried about. It's the finding something to get anchored in that is right up your alley, that's going to keep you motivated and consistent.
Okay, here is the real answer. You know, this is something that I've experienced so many times with clients. First of all, I think the entomology thing is a red herring. There are many kids. There's boys somehow have this thing about the love the gross and the unusual. If you had told me that in high school he was doing field studies and whatever, fine. But I'm sensing that that was just your tip. The same way as kids are boys are interested in monsters and dinosaurs and insects, I'm not sure that that's it. There are many. The reality, the real truth, in my judgment, is that there are, for the kid who simply likes learning, there are a million things that he could equally well do well in, and he's not going to get on fire until he gets into it. And so given that there are many things he could be interested in, it's normally wisest to at least start by springboarding on what his parents or a parent's friends or relatives could open unusual doors for. So if, for example, for whatever reason, let's say you or your husband or a relative is very well placed in some industry or some field or some nonprofit, getting him an internship or a volunteer or a summer experience there, and then taking courses, not even necessarily a major, but courses, doing fieldwork assignments, term papers that are synergistic with that, will either accelerate his interest in that, and now he's got a launch pad into something that he couldn't have gotten in the open market. Does that have any resonance as a concept?
Yes, I am an attorney and an educator. At the moment, I'm an educator, and he is running an after-school program. I got him a little job running an after-school program, motorizing bicycles with, you know, middle schoolers. So it's about the transference of energy. He's applied the science concepts to it, but it's also fun. So yeah, I hear you. And you know, maybe it's about something else. Maybe it's about consistency, follow through, and maybe that comes from another channel. Just super frustrating to have a super bright kid who is kind of floundering, and I'm trying to find a way as the parent. But you know, at the end of the day, maybe he's got to kind of find his own way. But I do like the you know, it doesn't have to be about a goal necessarily. And as an educator, college may not be for everyone.
That's right, or certainly a delay. Sometimes an interim year doing something powerful. Something that could make, you know, whether it be working in an orphanage or working in your law firm, giving him something important to do that makes him motivated. Barbara, I'm going to keep you, dear caller, you're an excellent caller. This is a very interesting issue with implications for many people, so you're not going anywhere. But I want Barbara, do you have anything you want to add here before I go back in and ask more questions for this wonderful caller?
No, this is absolutely your expertise, and you're doing great.
Okay, so the motivation question. It is the American way to do what you imply, which is maybe he needs to discover it on his own. I do not believe this. I don't know if it really that comes from my European background, where there was much more control that parents had over kids. Many kids, when they're 16 or 18, don't have that motivation, and they need to be pushed by the parent. I think that's part of, frankly, why so many Asian kids do well. If you needed to keep him close to you on some cool project, whether it be within your law firm or the education thing, that, you know, forgive the technical term, do you need to be busting his chops more or less given who he is and who you are?
Yeah, no, you say the tiger mom. I've been the tiger mom. And I have not gotten the kind of success. You know, that's not, I was a very, like, coachable kid, did well in school. I have a different personality.
Okay.
I responded, you know, and so, no, I've been the tiger mom, so now I feel like I kind of need to do a little hands-off.
Okay.
But the pushing part, though, but you see, I still have yet to let go, because I'm calling you to find out, maybe, is there some other way to figure out what might induce him to be motivated,
I'm looking at the clock. I'm going to have to stop you. The other angles are peers, if he should be going to a college or going to a place, is he with enough people who are high-powered peers, and is he likely to be subjected to be affected by that? I can't talk, but I would welcome your calling back again next week. You are exactly the kind of, the motivation question is so core. I would be happy to explore that with you further next week if you want to call in.
Okay, that'd be great. And in the interim, I am going to find some cool thing that we can do on the weekend, some kind of community service, something.
Right. And Barbara Nemko, you are certainly something cool. You've got 5 seconds. What's your last one-sentence contribution?
Find what you love. find a way to incorporate it into your life.
And I would say you don't have to love it. Sometimes, you know, loving it is not necessarily, it's realizing it being productive matters. Anyway, that's Work with Marty Emke for this week. Thank you, David Latulip, my board op, and all of you for listening and calling in. Next Sunday, a debate between a representative from the Bernie Sanders campaign and from the Marco Rubio campaign on which candidate would be better on jobs. Till next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco for Barbara, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For the archive of Dr. Marty Nemco's articles, information on his 7 books, including How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School, you can go to his website, martynemko.com. That's Marty, MartyNemko.com. And join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemko here on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco. Coming up next, it's Le Show with Le Harry Shearer. Stay with us.